We now begin our City Club of Idaho Falls rebroadcast, which typically occurs on the final Monday of every month at 7 p.m. here on KISU FM. This forum took place at the waterfront at Snake River Landing on August 8, 2019, and features Senator Mike Crapo.
I'm going to take a moment of personal privilege here before we get started today. These are really very serious times, and I want just to say a word. It's time for this nation to come together. It's time to end the hate and the rhetoric that inflames it. It's time to end bigotry and racism and the rhetoric that drives that. It is time to end the slaughter of innocent people. It is time to end the excessive partisanship that stands in the way of finding solutions for our nation's problems. It's time for America to reach down deep into our hearts and minds and with courage insist that we return to the best that we can be and that the best we can offer. It is time that we recapture our reputation as a nation devoted to freedom, filled with compassion and strength and tolerance and hope and leadership. In a moment, we will hear from a very powerful man, a good man, a devoted public servant, one of us. He must also hear from us. City Club encourages your thoughtful questions on subjects of your greatest concern. And now to introduce our speaker, our moderator, a founding member of this club, and president of the Alturas Institute, let me introduce Dr. David Adler.
Thank you very much, Tim. It was a treat for all of us to hear your very insightful, important, and elegant remarks today. Exactly what we expect from an elegant, distinguished attorney here in Idaho. Welcome, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be able to host the very distinguished U.S. senior senator from the state of Idaho, a man who needs no introduction in this room or throughout the state. After all, after you've served so successfully in Idaho politics since 1984, when Senator Crapo left his law practice to serve in the Idaho legislature, where he served for three terms, including a four-year stretch as Senate pro tem, before taking the leap from Idaho to go back to Washington and to serve three terms in the U.S. House of Representatives before successfully winning a seat in the United States Senate. When you've served so ably for now roughly 35 years in the public sphere, there are very few secrets. People know our speaker. But nonetheless, it's always worthwhile to comment on the great contributions from our speaker to the public world. Senator Crapo, as you know, is chair of the powerful Senate Banking Committee, where he's been at the middle of many of our greatest and most important financial matters for well more than a decade. He also serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Finance Committee, as well as a number of important subcommittees. He has been in the news recently for introducing a bipartisan bill to try to help free us all from those dreadful, annoying robocalls that we receive during the election campaign. Because my voice isn't the best, and because we're here to listen to Senator Crapo, I'm going to take my leave. Let us say what a very great pleasure it is to host you, Mike Crapo.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dave, for those great introductory remarks. And let me say at the outset, Tim Hopkins, amen to the comments that you made. I wish and hope and fight for the opportunity to get what you just said needs to happen in this country. We need it. I have about a 50-minute speech I want to give to you. I know you want me to keep it short so we can answer questions, and so Catherine's down here to give me the kill sign. And so let me just start out. What I want to do overall is to describe to you, the first thing most people ask me is, what's it like to serve with President Trump? I will respond to that. Next, I'm going to tell you what the Senate's like. And then I want to kind of go through some of the things. I think there actually are some pieces of good news coming out of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress. I want to go through that. And then I want to talk about some of the initiatives that I personally have been working on, and just kind of give you an overview of sort of what's happening in Washington from those perspectives. First of all, one of the most common questions I still get asked is, what's it like to work with President Trump? Well, it's interesting. I agree on the concerns about rhetoric. The tweets and things like that often cause political battles that actually, you know, we have to divert our attention to rather than focusing on the areas where we build consensus among ourselves, which we are doing, which I'll get to in a minute. On a policy level, I have really enjoyed the agenda that President Trump has pursued in Congress, and I'm going to talk about that in a little more detail. And he actually has been one of the most open presidents that I've served with, meaning if I call him on the phone, if I ask for a meeting with him, he'll return the call. Sometimes he even answers the phone. And that's an unusual thing for a president. So regardless of what one thinks about his politics or his personality, I have to tell you, he's been very good to work with in terms of both the agenda that I think was a good agenda and in terms of his openness and willing to work with us to help us get things done. Let me talk about just a couple of the successes that I think are important. And one, Tim, is the judicial arena. As I think most people know, the Senate is, contrary to the House, the Senate is in the personnel business. We do nominations and confirmations as well as legislation. When any president gets elected, that president has about 1,200 nominations to make that the Senate must confirm. Now, that's a bigger number than most people think. There has been a phenomenal, intense political battle over that, and I'm not going to spend any time going through that battle except to say that a part of that battle has been over judicial nominations. I think one of the big successes of this Congress is that we have been focusing on and intensely working on nominations. And for the federal courts, we have put into place two new Supreme Court nominees, and regardless of the battle over them, I believe they were outstanding, constitutional, rule of law-oriented judges who had excellent credentials. We've put in 43 new circuit court judges, one of which is an Idaho Falls hometown guy, Ryan Nelson, on the Ninth Circuit. And every one of these 43 judges has been a strong, solid, rule of law-oriented judge, which has had, it's about 25% of the judges on the Ninth Circuit, in the circuit courts across the country. And we've put in about 99 new district court judges across the country. Again, and there's been a big battle over these because there is a huge battle over what kind of judges should be in our judiciary. But these judges, in my opinion, are all solid, not biased, unless they're biased in favor of the Constitution and the rule of law, and good judges. So I think we've done really good things in that context. By the way, one of those district judges was another of our own from Southeast Idaho, Judge Nye, who is a new district court judge. And Jim Risch and I have introduced legislation to split the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's not bipartisan yet, but not without our effort. And we've introduced legislation to create a third judgeship for the state of Idaho. And I think that, Tim, we've talked about that a lot. A lot of the attorneys in the room will know. We're still working to find a pathway for that. The second thing is regulatory reform. One of the huge successes that over the last two or three years that hasn't been noticed. When President Trump was elected, there were around 99,000 pages of regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations. And regardless of how one feels about whether we need to have more or less regulations, I think that was way too much. And I think there were a lot of wrong-headed, harmful regulations that did not protect safety and soundness and the environment, but instead put a cold, wet blanket over our economy. Estimates from independent organizations are that we've lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 to 2% growth in our economy since about 1950 because of the regulatory excess. Both President Trump and the Congress have worked on reducing that, and now the number of pages is somewhere about 65 or 66,000. And although we still need to get it better and right-sized, there's great progress there, and it's already yielding significant impact on our economy. Another area is our national defense. One of the areas where we have increased spending is in our national defense. We badly had let our national defense deteriorate to a point where aggression from other nations was increasing because they increasingly felt that the United States was not in a position to push back. And we have begun a very major and already achieved very major improvements in our national defense, which is already having very major consequences with our NATO allies and other nations who are more aggressive around the globe, making America safer. And then finally, one of the major ones is tax reform. I want to take a minute on this one because it was an intense political battle. This was a controversial partisan battle. But most of you will remember I was a member of the group organized and created by President Obama called the Bowles-Simpson Commission to look at our fiscal crisis in the United States. And everybody remembers all of the effort we did there to try to control spending because that was the biggest part of our fiscal crisis. But one of the most significant things that that bipartisan Bowles-Simpson Commission agreed to was that we had to fix our tax code to generate stronger revenue and greater growth in the economy to deal with our fiscal crisis. We didn't get it done then, but we got it done now. And this tax reform is pretty much the exact model that the Bowles-Simpson Commission, on a bipartisan basis 10 years ago, agreed needed to be done. It wasn't bipartisan this time, but it did do what it was intended to do. It was attacked as simply a tax cut for the wealthy and an increase of the deficit. You'll remember all of that. The reality is that it was a tax cut for everyone, and every income cohort in the entire tax code got a tax rate reduction. And the rate reductions were a greater percentage for the lower income brackets than for the higher income brackets. In fact, the highest income bracket, I don't think, got any tax cut. And as far as impacting the fiscal policy of the country, a deficit, the reason it was claimed to be a deficit is because the United States economy had not grown more than 1.9% for the previous 10 years before we passed this law. And 2%, basically, was considered by most to be the new norm for the United States economy. The historic average for the 50 years, counting that 10 years, was 3.2%. And we argued that we could get back to a higher rate of growth for this country if we didn't have a tax code that was the most complex, the most unfair, the most expensive to comply with, and the most anti-competitive to our own interests that we could probably have designed. So we changed it. On the fiscal level, if the growth of the country, the GDP, remained at 1.9%, then it would have generated that $1.4 trillion deficit that was used to attack it. And if we could have gotten the economy just to increase to 2.3%, the tax code would have been fiscally neutral. The revenue lost through rate reductions would have been replaced by growth in the economy. Anything above 2.3% would be a revenue surplus over existing law and actually help reduce the deficit. So what's happened? Amidst the attacks that we were devastating our fiscal policy, the average rate of growth for the economy since the passage of the tax bill is exactly what we predicted and expected it to be. It's grown from, the average is around 3.1%. And every tenth of a percent is hundreds of billions of dollars of revenue to the Treasury, not to mention the growth in the economy. The results of that have been phenomenal. Wages have grown, jobs have grown, capital formation has exploded, and economic growth, as I said, has literally grown about 50% across the country. And so, again, I just wanted you to know that I think there have been, this is when I say I appreciate the policies the president has worked with us to achieve. This is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Now, I was going to go over a whole bunch of other things, that have, good things that have happened on a bipartisan basis that just don't really get reported, but I'm just going to hit them really fast and then run to the rest of my speech. Major legislation to help our 9/11 first responders, a package of about 100 bills in our natural resources management arena, which included things like making the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanently authorized and improving the preservation and strengthening of our natural resources across this nation. Bipartisan legislation, massive. IRS reform to put more fairness, streamlining, and frankly, accountability into the operations of the Internal Revenue Service. The banking reform, by the way, this was the first major bipartisan legislation that happened in this last Congress, and it was my bill. So I want you to know that. Thank you. We broke the ice. We were having an intense bipartisan battle with a desert of legislation. We got it through, and this was massively important. It sounds like, you know, banking legislation. It sounds like it's not that big of a deal. It's increased the availability of capital from our small and medium-sized financial institutions, significantly helping to grow that number that has been helping to grow our economy. Landmark opioid legislation, again, bipartisan, doesn't really get a lot of attention because it wasn't the big fight. Major veterans legislation, and again, I'm not going to go through it unless you want to ask about it. Energy policy legislation, opening access in our country to energy and helping to drive down the cost, in fact, reduce the potential dependency of the United States, returning to dependency on other sources of energy. Fighting sex trafficking. The list goes on. I'm going to move on. There were a number of successes also that are important for us here in Idaho. In fact, right here for Idaho Falls in this community. I'm going to focus on nuclear issues. We passed, again, this was my legislation along with Senator Risch and Senator Whitehouse, a Democrat, that would help deal with improving and strengthening and incentivizing and enhancing the growth of nuclear policy in the United States. One was the NECA legislation, N-E-I-C-A, which would basically help remove barriers to the development of technologies that allow for advanced and more efficient use of energy. And one thing it did was it created a new National Reactor Innovation Center that we are hoping will be located here in Idaho. It was intended by us as we moved it for that to happen, but of course that has to be a decision that's made regulatorily. Another bill, which is the NEMA bill, which is a bill that actually, again, facilitates the cooperation and facilitation of research and development of new technologies in energy and allows for more private sector government cooperation in moving those technologies forward. There's also a new versatile test reactor, a project that's something that was referenced in our NECA bill that is now located, in fact, is located here in at the INL, a major new development. And of course, we've been working to help the NuScale SMR project. And I'm not going to go through the benefits of that, except to say that Senator Risch and I are helping to try to get the $150 million that's needed to help facilitate the NRC licensing, and we're going to hopefully be successful in getting that done. So, again, just a number of areas where we have been successful in this Congress in moving things forward. I'm going to skip over a whole bunch of stuff we did for our resources here in Idaho and some of those things, and go to, just to finish up and try to get finished here, talk about some of the other issues that I'm working on personally right now that aren't yet legislation but that I think will be. Well, one that is legislation is Senator Wyden and I. Am I out of time yet? 5 minutes. Okay, I'll do this really fast. Senator Wyden and I teamed up for forest fire borrowing solutions, a big issue for the entire forest industry in the United States. And I don't mean industry, but for all aspects of forest management in the United States. That became law and solved a huge critical thing. Again, a bipartisan bill that made it through in this Congress. Senator Wyden and I have teamed up again to put together a permanent trust fund solution for the Secure Rural Schools legislation to help deal with our strapped rural counties, particularly across the country, but Idaho is my focus, to help them deal with the fact they don't have property tax revenue from federal lands in their counties. Another very big issue. But I want to end with just the couple of minutes I have left with something that I'm really focused on. Well, actually two things. One, the Banking Committee, this one's law, and I do want to mention it. There's been a lot of focus on Russia recently and for the last couple of years. Well, it turns out that economic sanctions are in the Banking Committee. And again, not reported very much and not really focused on much is in the last Congress, just about a year and a half ago, I helped as the chairman of the committee work with other colleagues in the Senate to develop a bill to impose major sanctions on Russia for its election interference, for its aggression in the Crimea, and for other aspects of its aggression that were increasing and that our NATO allies were increasingly concerned with. This bill made it, again, it was bipartisan. It made it into law. The president signed it. And more sanctions have actually been imposed on Russia than ever before in our country's dealings with Russia in order to deal with these things. And more can be and will be probably imposed. So the last thing I do want to jump into and talk about that it's not law yet, but which we are aggressively engaged on in the Banking Committee, is what I call big data, cryptocurrency, and robocalls. I'll start with robocalls. It's really easy. Senator Klobuchar, one of the Democrat candidates for president, and I, on a bipartisan basis, have introduced a bill to help control the robocalls. I'll leave that at that, unless you want to get some more details on it. On cryptocurrency, this is using the blockchain technology on the internet to basically establish new currencies. As you might guess, that creates a big concern in the economy because usually we have central banks that control currency, and now we have, in this case, the most recent one, Facebook deciding it's going to get into the currency business. And we already have Bitcoin and a number of others. This is a technology that's here today, an innovation that's here today and here to stay. But it is a huge issue as to I don't think that it's possible for this to be stopped, but we need to have the United States engaged on this and setting the rules of the road for how this plays out across the globe. And that's one of the phenomenally interesting and difficult issues that we're dealing with on the Banking Committee right now. And I'll wrap up with big data. I believe that most Americans don't understand how much personal data about them is being collected. They don't understand about them on the internet. They don't understand when, which is about every second that you are on the internet, and sometimes when you don't think you're on the internet. They don't know when it's being collected, what is being collected, who's collecting it, what it's being used for. They have no right to opt out. They have no right to review the data that's been collected and correct it or ask that it be erased. And they have no right to have an opinion or input on what that data is used for. And the data is, I don't have time to go through it all right now, but the data is explosive about what they are collecting on individuals. And it's gone way beyond just helping you see the ads that you're interested in when you're on the internet. It's gotten to the point not just of that, but of actually using artificial intelligence, being able to predict behavior, and now they're moving into trying to manipulate behavior of individuals by the use of their data and the use of the messaging and other contacts and impacts they can create to have happen. I think it's alarming. We need legislation that will correct each of those. Individuals should have rights. They should have a right to know when data has been collected on them and be informed. They should have a right to know what data has been collected, what its purpose is, and they should have the right to opt out. They should have the right to review data that they do want to allow to be corrected. And frankly, for example, if you want to get a mortgage, you do want a credit company to collect some financial data on you so that you can get the mortgage you're applying for. But they have the right to agree which data is collected, and they should have the right to review that data to make sure that it's accurate. And they should have the right to say after the mortgage application is finished and the loan is issued, to have the data removed if they want to. And there should be corresponding obligations, and certain uses of data should be prohibited. This is a phenomenally huge issue, and I think it's one that cries out for a solution. It's another one that's global, not just US. It's one that causes us to have to work with other countries. I was in the European Union a few months back, and the European Union has passed a law similar to this, and they want to be really sure that what we do is consistent with what they do, because a lot of the companies, most of the big data collectors, most of whose names you probably aren't familiar with, are operating globally. And so we need to coordinate with not just the 50 states in the United States, but with the countries of the world. And we have some belligerent countries on this issue. So you can see how complicated this issue is, but how important it is. And it's a critically important issue that we're jumping into in the Banking Committee. So I didn't even talk about half the stuff I wanted to talk with you about. There is a lot going on. Beyond what you see as the battles that are presented in the national media, those battles are going on too. But the bottom line is, we are having those mean-spirited fights. We are also having successes among those of us who are willing to try to work together and get legislation done. And I wanted you to know that in the context of what's happening in the country right now. So with that, let me stop and we can go to the questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much. Given the fact you've only been able to discuss half of what you intended to discuss, let us here right now invite you to return to take up the latter half of your agenda. We'll work with your staff to find a date.
All right.
Because it's all the more important because by my count, we have a record number of questions. Over the 12 years...
I don't
years,
know if I'm glad to make that record.
There are well more than 100 questions here. A number of them, this comes as no surprise, fall into particular categories. A lot of members here of your audience want to ask you about guns, gun violence, proposed regulations. A lot of questions want to talk more about Russian interference in the 2016 election. Some questions about immigration and other fun questions for you.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
I know you enjoy taking. Let's start with a couple questions that bear on your opening remarks about Russia. You noted that your own committee, the Banking Committee, has been the stalwart leader in imposing sanctions. As chair of that, imposing sanctions on Russia, as chair of that committee, Senator, do you find it disconcerting to note the disconnect between your efforts and those of your colleagues to impose sanctions and the rhetoric and public statements of the President of the United States with respect to Russian interference in the 2016 election, principally the fact that all of our intelligence agencies have agreed that Putin interfered on behalf of Donald Trump? Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, yes. The answer is yes. The rhetoric that we deal with, as I indicated at the outset, interferes often with our ability to actually achieve results and then implement those results. Now, when I say that, though, it's not just the president's, but it does include the rhetorical battles that we get engaged in. Let me comment a little bit about the imposition of sanctions on Russia. And what the findings were. The findings were that, yes, every intelligence agency agreed that Russia tried to interfere with our elections, but failed. Now, what does that mean? They actually failed on one piece of their effort and succeeded on other pieces, one other piece. The part that they tried to do is they tried to get into the ballot box and change votes. And that is where they failed. We have since responded to that with significantly hardening our ballot boxes. Now, that's a state issue, but we have begun working with the states to assure that the ballot boxes are even better prepared and that we as a nation are even better prepared for those kinds of intrusive efforts in the future. It's not limited to Russia who's trying to get into our ballot boxes. Secondly, another thing that you can do to influence an election is to influence social media and messaging that is coming out, and information that is being given to the American people. That's one place where Russia did very successfully establish social media messaging systems that submitted messages. And yes, I'm offended that was successful and allowed. And we are working to try to solve that. It's a harder one to solve because the First Amendment doesn't allow us to go in and pull down people's communication. But you know, when it's Russia doing it, I think that there's a way for us to get at that. What we've got to do is to figure out how to solve that, and we are working on getting that done. So anyway, I don't mean to give too long answers to your questions.
Thank you. As a follow-up, what's your view about the fact that President Trump said at an international conference that he would prefer to take the word of Vladimir Putin about interference versus non-interference in the election, as opposed to all of the intelligence agencies' conclusions that Russia did interfere?
Yeah, that was disconcerting. Yes, I didn't agree with that.
Disconcerting?
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think I can't say this with absolute confidence, but I believe that the president was encouraged by many of us and did clarify that. But the bottom line is, yeah, that was not helpful.
Thank you. Another follow-up question then. Didn't mean to cut you off. Did you want to say
no,
more
that's
not helpful? Okay. Another follow-up question then. You mentioned the sanctions as an effort to harden our and protect our election ballots this next time around. There's a very important piece of legislation pending in the United States Senate, and that's the Election Security Act. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he will not hold a hearing on it. If you're concerned about America's national defense and protecting our sovereignty and the integrity of our elections, wouldn't you be interested in pushing the Senate leader to hold a debate and a vote on that?
Well, actually, I guess I don't agree with your characterization that Mitch McConnell won't let that happen. Mitch McConnell has encouraged the Senate committee chairman to not only hold hearings, but to evaluate all. There's not just that bill that's been introduced. There's another number of bills that have been introduced. And he's encouraged us to look at those bills very carefully and find if we can build, again, a bipartisan agreement on how to move forward. There is some partisanship still going on in this arena, and the legislation needs to be good. You know, it needs to be bipartisan, and it needs to be focused on dealing with Russia. And that we are working on at this moment.
Thank you. Let's shift to the topic of the day. Many audience members here have submitted questions related to yet another tragedy, two tragedies in our country, the mass killings in El Paso and Dayton. By way of background, I think many of your audience members know that you were given an A-plus rating by the National Rifle Association in 2012 after the slaughter in Newtown, and you indicated that you would filibuster any proposals to add more regulations to our gun laws. With that background then, what is your view about restrictions on gun rights, and what regulations and restrictions would you be willing to accept?
Well, I'm not sure, again, about your characterization about the comments that were attributed to me, but let me answer the question. First of all, I am a very strong and long-time supporter of the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, and I have consistently said that I believe that the solution is going to be in identifying potentially dangerous behavior and interceding with it, rather than moving ahead with trying to ban gun ownership in the United States. Now, if that's, you know, what people are concerned about, I will just say that's where I stand. That being said, we have legislation, we have restrictions on gun ownership and gun purchases already in place, and we actually added to that in the last Congress. That was one of the pieces of bipartisan legislation that I didn't list. In fact, there were two pieces of it. One of them was to harden our schools against and give greater protection in our schools against violence. And the other was to actually amend and strengthen the National Instant Criminal Background Check system to make sure that it worked better and more effectively. Now, some want us to expand that background check system to situations like which are not covered now. Like transfers between family members of firearms, like if a father or mother wants to give their firearms to their children, or if children want to give one to each other, or if someone passes away and the estate needs to transfer the ownership of those firearms to children in the family, Should those people have to go to a licensed gun dealer and go through the process of a background check? I don't think so. So, you know, there are some differences of opinion that we have on those kinds of things, but the notion that we should not focus on trying to look at every aspect of dealing with firearms as well as with violence is one that I'm open to. I'm open to looking at everything, but looking at the ones that will work.
Thank you. Let's go down a list then of proposals.
Sure.
Setting aside family transfer of guns, are you in favor of expanded background checks for the sale of guns at gun shows and in every other venue across the country?
Yes, with one further exception. And that is, right now, I believe it is the law that every commercial sale of firearms is subject to a background check, even at gun shows. And in fact, I don't know the statistic, but it's something like 90%+ of the sales at gun shows are of that kind. And if someone tries to, an individual tries to come to a gun show who's not a licensed firearm dealer and sell guns, that is not allowed if they do that as a practice. And that's covered as well. So what's the exception that's there, which is the one that I think we need to look at, is whether it should be expanded to individuals being able to sell a firearm to someone else other than their family member. When they're not in the business, they just have a firearm that they want to sell. And, you know, I think that that's an arena where it's open to debate, maybe open to getting a reasonable level of evaluation there.
Senator, 9 states have passed laws requiring gun licenses and registration. In those states, we've seen a decline in both homicide as well as suicide. Do you support licensing and registration for firearms?
I don't. I do not believe the government should create a list of the guns that are owned by individuals in America.
Do you see a Second Amendment problem with that? And if so, what is your objection?
I do see a Second Amendment problem with that, and it's one that has been very strongly expressed over the years as Congress dealt with legislation. And that is, if the government can create a list of all the guns that individuals and Americans own, then it's only one more step for the government to confiscate them. And by the way, in some states, that's actually being done. So, I mean, not a complete confiscation, but that road is starting to be traveled, and I don't believe in that.
So you perceive a parade of horribles once we start down that road of licensing and registration?
Well, again, your characterization is not one I would adopt, but I do see the problem of the government identifying everyone who owns a gun and what guns they own. I see that as a problem.
You're not one of the senators who views the Second Amendment as a list of categorical rights.
I view the Second Amendment as a constitutional right that individuals have. It's an individual constitutional right. And by the way, that's what the Supreme Court ruled in the recent case that dealt with that issue.
But nevertheless, subject to some regulation.
Oh yes, it's subject to regulation, and we have intense regulations on it. For example, we regulate what kinds of firearms can be owned. We regulate, we have the instant criminal background check, and we have a number of other regulations that deal with firearms.
Yeah. That raises 2 questions. President Trump has said he believes the principal problem is related to mental health issues. Those acquiring weapons who have mental health issues, he would like to curb that. Where do you stand on the suggestion that people with mental health difficulties should not be able to obtain firearms?
I agree, but when you the question is in defining mental health issues. But I believe under the law today, it is law today and has been since I believe the 1970s, that a person who is mentally ill and determined by a judge to be dangerous can have their Second Amendment rights removed or limited. Now, just going back a few years, the president implemented an order saying that all veterans who have had a head injury, and we're talking concussive injuries or any number of other injuries, should be subject to not a judge, but an official at the Veterans Administration saying, you can have your Second Amendment rights taken away. No finding of violence or potential violence, not even a finding of mental illness, but a finding of a head injury. The same kind of thing was done with the Social Security Administration. A person who is elderly, who files for Social Security, can ask that an assistant, like a spouse or a child, be nominated or created to be authorized to help them deal with the Social Security Administration on their benefits. So the order was that the Social Security Administration should take those people who ask for assistance in filing for their Social Security benefits and say that they are mentally incompetent and no finding of violence, but just that that's mental incompetence that justifies taking away their Second Amendment rights. I don't agree with that. So my point is, the question is, do I believe that that's a fair place to go? Yes, and it already is the law, and we may need to beef that up. But we need to be sure that a person's constitutional rights are not taken away from them by bypassing our judicial system and just going to an administrative official. And we need to be sure that we're focused on findings that legitimately indicate that they are a person who is likely to commit violence.
So in your reference to HJ Resolution 40, which you supported and which the president signed into law in February of 2017, that was a piece of legislation that said that those people who require a representative to handle their financial checks from the Social Security Administration should be prohibited from accessing firearms. You supported that, and yet that piece of legislation would have prevented people with mental health disabilities to the degree they're not competent to handle their financial matters, would have kept firearms out of their hands. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, I guess I don't remember that.
You voted for it.
I'm going to have to go look at it because I don't believe that I ever voted for that. In fact, I tried to reject that rule. So if I did vote for that, I'm not even going to say that I did vote for that because I don't believe I did.
Okay. So, Senator, moving along here, do you think that President Trump's rhetoric on the question of invasion at our southern border, infestation in some of our southern cities, has had an impact on some of those people who have used guns in some of these latest tragedies?
I would say that you mean in the last two tragedies?
In El Paso, for example.
I don't know how to predict whether his statements caused that particular individual to exhibit incredible hatred. This was not it may have been a mental illness case, but it was a hate case. And I don't know. I can't predict that.
And of course, the perpetrator in El Paso quoted some of Donald Trump's language about invasion and how Democrats want to maintain open borders. So if you're not fully familiar with that, more broadly speaking, is it the case that the president's words matter?
Of course they do. Of course they do. And let me say, I've had many people say to me that President Trump is responsible in what he says for lots of things. He's been responsible for the last hurricanes. He's been responsible for these last shootings. And I get where that's all coming from. But my point to you would be, Elizabeth Warren was accused by some of inciting this because I don't know what she said and whether she said anything, but she said something that one of the other shooters quoted or something like that. I'm not going to assert that except to say I've read that there's allegations that she should be blamed for something. I don't believe that that's the direction we ought to go. That this is the kind of mean-spirited conflict that we need to reduce, not increase. Character assassination should not be the political weapon of the day. We need to look at the causes of the violence and deal with the gun side of it and deal with the mental illness side of it, deal with the hate side of it, and all other aspects of it. And that's where we should be focusing our attention rather than trying to place blame on one person or another.
Thank you. You heralded the tax cut in 2017, which disproportionately preferred the top 1% in our economy. The nonpartisan Congressional Research Service has indicated since that date that the federal deficit has risen by 23% and the federal debt by $4 trillion during President Trump's office. term in office. That was supposed to be a tax cut that would pay for itself. How do you explain the consequences?
I really appreciate that question. Because, as I indicated, the tax cut has way more than paid for itself. It has generated hundreds of billions of dollars to the Treasury. The deficit has still gone up. Why? Because the deficit is the excess of all of the spending that is happening beyond the revenue that's coming in. Had we not passed the tax cut, had we stayed at 1.9% economic growth, that number would have been higher. The deficit will go up under any president. If a new president were elected in the next election and stepped into office, the same attack could be made on that president no matter what happens, because the deficit is skyrocketing out of control. It is screaming toward pushing the U.S. into insolvency. And the majority of the reason for the drive in deficit or in fiscal policy increase is the entitlement sector of the spending in the United States, which is now well over 60%, approaching 70% of all spending. And you remember that Congress doesn't vote on that because it takes 60 votes to change it, and we never get 60 votes to change it. And like I say, you can pass a good new tax law that increases revenue, the deficit's still going to outgrow that. Until we pass some kind of law that increases revenue by $1 trillion a year, we're still going to see deficits go up. We need to deal with deficits.
That's the deficit side. On the tax cut, it increased the debt by $1 trillion. Now we're up to $4 trillion on Trump's watch. As a self-proclaimed deficit hawk and an eagle eye on the debt, how do you explain that?
Well, again, I don't agree with the facts in the question. The tax cut did not increase the deficit by a dime. It decreased the deficit, and I don't have the number on that, but it's by hundreds of billions of dollars. And so, am I a deficit hawk? Yeah. I've fought for 10 years to make this kind of change in our tax policy to strengthen and grow the economy. It's an important part of deficit control. As to the spending side, I've fought for the budgets. As people probably could recall here, we've had some government shutdowns over those fights, where we've fought to control Congress's overspending, and I've been on the side of overspending in those fights. Where we can't get a handle on it, and by the way, we've succeeded. We've kept our discretionary spending, as opposed to our entitlement spending, at a growth rate lower than the rate of the growth of the economy for probably 10 years now. Where we can't get a handle on it is the entitlement spending, the mandatory spending. And by the way, now the interest on the national debt, which the only way we can control that is to control the rest of it.
Let's shift to immigration, a very complicated issue. But one questioner wonders, are you concerned about human rights abuses at our southern border?
Of course I am. And in fact, that's another bipartisan success that we had in the middle of this battle over immigration and the border. The one thing we could get done bipartisanly is to authorize $4.6 billion, I think, to go down and try to deal with the crisis we're having at the border. And I think that's a very critical thing, and we need to deal with it now, not just in terms of providing the relief that we've authorized to be provided, but we need to deal with our immigration laws so that we stop the crisis from happening at the border.
Are you in favor of granting green card status to the roughly 10 to 15 million undocumented immigrants in our country as a means of moving forward? Your colleague in the House, Representative Simpson, touts that idea.
Yeah, well, the answer is has to be explained in a different way. I believe that no one who enters the United States illegally should be given an advantage toward citizenship or permanent legal residence, which is a green card. Because if we do that, we will incentivize illegal entrance into the country. That being said, I do believe that a legal status, not a green card, but a legal status for those who are here working in our economy in the black market, if you will, can come out of that system and find a way to be a part of our economy and a part of our society. They want to do that. And I think that's a healthy thing for our country. But if they want to then further go another step to get a green card, then I believe they should get in the back of the line with those who did it legally and not get an advantage toward it that others who followed the law did not do.
Shifting gears here for a moment. You mentioned in your opening remarks that the Senate has a major constitutional responsibility to grant advice and consent to presidential nominations. One of our questioners asked, are you alarmed by the number of acting members of the president's cabinet and other key positions that require confirmation?
Yes, I am, but I may be meaning something different than the question intended. I referenced earlier that there's about 1,200 nominations that the Senate has to do. The pushback against President Trump has been phenomenal in terms of getting his nominees confirmed. Obviously, out of that 1,200, there's probably, actually, the first group that's the most important is the cabinet members you referenced. That's like 20, the cabinet members and some of the sub-cabinet members, like the U.S. trade ambassador. That's about 21. Most presidents get their cabinet and their U.S., well, their sub-cabinet members within 2 weeks. Barack Obama got 9 of those 21 when he, on the same day, he was confirmed into office. President Trump got 2 on his first day. That was the Defense Department and Homeland Security, because there was no way they could stop those two cabinet members from being confirmed. He didn't get his cabinet and sub-cabinet members until May. And most presidents get theirs within the first 2 weeks. And it's been that way all the way through, because filibusters have been used to stop President Trump from getting his nominees confirmed. So I'm alarmed by that. We still aren't there. We're 2.5 years into the presidency, and we still aren't there. And it's at the 2.5 year mark where some people retire and move on. And those positions we're having hard times refilling. And so I think there's a huge concern, a huge concern there.
Another facet of that, Senator, is President Trump has said he likes, quote unquote, acting directors because then he can fire them at will. But are you concerned about the constitutional role of the Senate to vet these nominees to grant advice and consent? Do you feel that you're being deprived of the exercise of your constitutional duty?
I feel we are being stopped from exercising it, but not by President Trump. When he makes a nomination, it's in the Senate's ballpark at that point. And when the president said that, what I interpreted him saying was not that he liked to go around Congress, but that Congress would not act on his nominees. And so that he has to put someone into act while he's waiting for the Senate to act on them. I really believe the battle here is obstruction. Let me give you an example. If a nominee is filibustered, it takes between 2 to 5 days to beat that filibuster and vote on the nominee. That's one nominee in about every 2 days at the max. If you multiply that times 1,200, you can see what we're talking about. Judge Nye, that I referenced earlier, was one of the judicial nominees. He had been appointed by President Obama, or nominated by President Obama. President Trump renominated him following President Obama's lead. He came out of the Judiciary Committee unanimously, both under President Obama's nomination and President Trump's nomination. He went to the floor. He was filibustered. It took us 3 days to get a vote on him. The vote was 100 to nothing. That's what we're dealing with, and that's the obstruction that I'm talking about. And so, you know, when we raise these issues with regard to personnel, as I said at the outset, my alarm may not be what the questioner intended to say by using that word. I don't think the president is trying to bypass Congress. The president is sending us nominees on a regular basis, and we are not doing our business.
Let's shift for a moment to climate change. In yet another very grim report, the United Nations just yesterday issued a report that the world's food supply is greatly endangered by climate change. A, do you believe in climate change? Is it a fact, not fiction? And B, what policies are you prepared to support or endorse as a means of addressing this very serious issue?
Yes, I do believe in climate change. You know, we argue a lot, not we, but America argues a lot about who caused it and what the causes are. I don't think that's the debate we should be having. We should be having the debate about whether it's real, and it's real. Your question was, what solutions do I think we should adopt? There have been a number of solutions proposed that I have objected to because the impact they would have on climate change would have been infinitesimal almost, and the impact they would have had on people and our economy would have been huge. Those kinds of solutions, I believe, are damaging. I mean, incredibly more damaging to people than a number of the other things that are being talked about in the context of climate change. That being said, we need to move to more energy-efficient fuels. We need to move in the direction of being being able to use sustainably more appropriate fuels to deal with climate change, and that's probably the biggest area that we could do something about. And I've long supported moving to alternative fuels and so forth. If we do that, it's going to take us a decade or so to transition, and we need to facilitate that, but we need to do it in a way that will not devastate people in the process. And there are some proposals now moving in Congress, or now being, I shouldn't say moving, they're now being negotiated and worked through in Congress to create incentives in our tax code for transitioning to new energy systems. I'm open to looking at those. There are other approaches to looking at developing a strong research effort. You know, the United States has a history of solving problems, and I think we can solve this one. There's those who are looking at finding other energy sources that we don't even have in the play yet. And by the way, the talk I referenced earlier about nuclear energy, one of the major reasons we were able to build a bipartisan solution for those energy nuclear energy bills that I referenced was because of climate change. And we are, you know, nuclear energy is one of the best kinds of energies we should migrate to. So yeah, there are a lot of solutions we need to do, but there's a lot of proposals that would be very devastating without much benefit. And so that's where we've got to find the right path.
Thank you. Back to guns for a moment. A very important question, much on the minds of Americans today. Do you support banning military-style assault weapons, such as the AK-47 and the AR-15 with a high-capacity volume, volume?
Right. When you talk about assault weapons, and you use the word military-style, and I will get back to that. True assault weapons, the automatic machine guns that the military uses, are already banned in the United States and have been since the 70s. What is being referenced there is a firearm that is frankly the most common firearm for hunters and shooting recreationists in the United States. It's a semi-automatic firearm, as you indicated, with a high magazine, like 30 rounds can fit in the magazine. The point I want to make is the effort to ban semi-automatic firearms is one that would ban most, not all, but a huge majority of the firearms that law-abiding citizens in the United States now use and own. I'm not in favor of that kind of a ban. I am fully in favor of dealing with some of the modifications that have been made and some of the other ways to utilize those firearms to make them closer to a true military-style firearm.
So if you're opposed to banning those kinds of weapons, where do you stand on legislation that would limit the magazine capacity to, say, 10 rounds as opposed to 30? Because as a follow-up, what hunter needs more than 10 rounds in hunting a deer or an elk?
Yeah, I think that that's a fair question. I haven't come down on that yet. Part of the reason for that is, you know, you can switch out magazines really fast. I'm not sure that solution really achieves much. But then one would say, well, then you can only have one magazine. And I have to look at that issue.
Thank you. Let's shift to the president's assertion of power. 2 weeks ago, President Trump asserted that he has unlimited power under Article 2. As a senior senator in a coordinate branch, how do you feel about that assertion?
I didn't hear him say that, so I'm not going to confirm that he did, but I don't agree with that. And I believe that not only does the president have limits on his or her authority, but I also believe that Congress has done an abysmal job of protecting its own jurisdiction and rights and authorities under the Constitution and has yielded to the president phenomenal powers. So it is true that the president does, under constitutions and statutes that Congress has passed, have phenomenal power. But I and a number of my colleagues are aggressively engaged, whether it's President Trump or anybody else, in trying to change those delegations of authority from Congress and pull that authority back, I mean, from Congress to the president, and pull that authority back to Congress.
Shifting to foreign affairs for a moment, President Trump has aggrandized foreign affairs powers in a way that few presidents have. What do you think about his demeaning comments about some of our oldest allies, his practice of denigrating Great Britain and France and so forth?
Well, I don't agree necessarily with the rhetoric, but I do agree that our NATO allies needed to be brought up to dealing with their obligations under NATO, which they have been abandoning for years. And I think some tough talk needed to happen. Now, whether the exact talk that happened was the best way to do it, I'm not going to say that. I think it could have been said better, maybe. But the bottom line is that our allies needed to step up. And by the way, they admit that, and they've done that. And I think it was very helpful for that to happen.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis sweeping America. Does Big Pharma have a role? Should it be held accountable for its role in promoting the opioid crisis? And if so, what positions are you willing to adopt to rein in Big Pharma?
Well, first of all, absolutely Big Pharma should have a role. In fact, I don't even know that the role it should play is that it should be regulated more aggressively in the context of opioids. One of the bills I did reference that we did on a bipartisan basis was a major opioid intervention piece of legislation that we passed last Congress on a bipartisan basis. We need to fully see that implemented and then see if further things need to be done. The Finance Committee that I sit on deals with the pharmaceutical industry and drug pricing in general, going beyond opioids. And what we're seeing is that with the new inventions, the new drugs that are being developed, they're being developed now so rapidly. And by the way, this is a good thing. The research and development of new pharmaceutical products is a good thing. But it is resulting in really expensive research and products, and in many cases, circumstances in which one company controls the patent to one drug that is a critical drug. And then we get into a monopoly situation where the price, like insulin is a good example out there, where the cost of some of these products is devastating to any American family. And they need them for their life, for their health. And so it's really important for us to engage. I think we have to engage and find a solution to this. What that solution is, I don't know. We have just passed a bill out of the Finance Committee that deals with this issue. I didn't support it in the committee. I supported about 80% of it. But the final piece of it was to engage in authorizing what I consider to be basically government price fixing. I'm not ready to go to government price fixing in any part of our market yet. But something needs to be done, and we'll have to see where we get there. We have to solve this problem.
A couple of quick questions for you. Do you believe that all presidential candidates should release their tax returns?
I actually don't believe that that's something that we should push in our society.
Why not, Senator?
Because I think that it just, under the Internal Revenue Code, as I mentioned earlier, the information that is provided in tax returns can be utilized to make all kinds of accusations and claims. There was a kind of a program that was done by one of the magazines about 10 years ago where they took a typical family of four and submitted a factual situation to about three big accounting firms and a couple small accounting firms and had them say, do the tax return for this family. And they got five different results. And actually, it was probably a different result than the IRS would have gotten to. And my point is, it becomes a political weapon. And I think that's the reason that the demands for it are being made.
Here are a couple very current questions for you. Do you agree with President Trump that China has engaged in currency manipulation?
I absolutely do. In fact, it's been doing so for more than a decade, and I was actually the sponsor of legislation with one of my Democrat colleagues on the Finance Committee about 10 years ago to statutorily designate them as a currency manipulator.
6 months ago, President Trump said that we were near a deal with China on trade policy. Now we're engaged in a trade war. Your thoughts?
We were close to a deal 6 months ago, but it wasn't a deal that the highest leadership in China had signed off on. And what happened is when the Chinese negotiators went back to China and said, here's what we've agreed to, President Xi said, no, that isn't what we agreed to. So it got pushed back. I believe that the trade war that is underway right now and the tariff engagement that the president has engaged in, not only with China, but with the European Union and with Canada and Mexico, it was necessary for some president someday and sooner than later to step up to these countries and tell them they had to stop their anti-competitive conduct toward the United States. That I agreed with. The trade war creates great difficulty. It's a two-edged sword. I want to have an outcome soon. So my thoughts on the China as well as European Union and Canada and Mexico solution or issues are, I believe we should continue to push for resolving these anti-competitive actions toward the United States. I believe we're there for Canada and Mexico. Now we're just waiting for the House to pass the bill and pass it in the Senate. And we will have not only resolved the issue, we will have created a strengthened posture for us in our two biggest trading partners. So anyway, it's a two-edged sword. Your question was, what do I feel about it? I'm very sad that we have to be in this position of taking these strong positions, but I believe that we need to, or America will just continuously be injured by this conduct that these other nations are engaging in.
Our time together is rapidly coming to an end. I think we only have two more hours together.
I have a town meeting I got to get to at some point. Am I about right? My timekeeper says I need to run. But
well, this is sort of a town hall meeting.
That's right. It's a great one.
A couple quick questions then for you. We're heading toward a global slowdown. How do you feel about President Trump's criticisms of the Federal Reserve? And that's a particularly important question for you as chair of the Senate Banking Committee.
Well, first of all, a lot of people have said the president shouldn't criticize the Federal Reserve because they're an independent bank. They're an independent national bank. But frankly, I don't know of a president who hasn't commented on the Federal Reserve. I know that I personally, as a United States senator, we have jurisdiction over the Federal Reserve in my banking committee, and we bring the head of the Federal Reserve in front of us every year. And I engage in serious engagement with him or her about what it is that the Fed's doing and why they're doing this and why not doing that. I don't think there's any problem at all, nor is it wrong for elected officials to say that they don't like what the Federal Reserve is doing or to say that they like what the Federal Reserve is doing. So in that context, I don't think the president is undercutting their independence. I guarantee you, I know and communicate regularly with the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve, and these are very independent people. They have 14-year terms, okay? And so, I mean, they are independent. Now, as to the exact detail of what the president has said, I have agreed with the president that the Federal Reserve raised interest rates too fast. And in fact, I personally have said publicly that I thought the Federal Reserve should reduce interest rates. So as far as the substance, as opposed to the tone and the rest of it, I've agreed with the comments. And I appreciated the fact that a big majority of the Federal Reserve agreed with that this last time around. But I'll tell you, I don't believe the reason the Federal Reserve Board agreed with that is because President Trump was critical of them. I think that they are very capable, independent people who agreed, finally, that the economy had heated up more than they thought. And by the way, that's the heating up of the economy that I was talking about earlier, that happened faster than they thought it was going to happen, and they needed to reduce rates. So anyway, that's where I stand on.
You're leading on legislation to split the Ninth Circuit. What are your reasons for doing that?
The Ninth Circuit is one of the, well, not one of the, it's the largest circuit in the United States. It's got 29 judges on it. And it's just unwieldy. It also has the hugest caseload in the United States. The delay that is there and the inefficiencies that are there are phenomenal. By the way, it also has the biggest record of being reversed at the Supreme Court. But my bill doesn't deal with its policy decision-making or its judicial decision-making. My bill just splits it. And by the way, for those that don't study Ninth Circuit issues, this is California. And now I'm going to get in trouble. Montana, Wyoming, Oregon. Keep me on it here, Tim.
Washington.
Hawaii and Alaska, Guam, and the Mariana Islands. And of all of those members of the Ninth Circuit, California is significantly more than 50% of all the caseload. So what we do is we put California and Hawaii and Guam and the Mariana Islands in one circuit, and we give them, I think, 21 judges. And that's still going to be the biggest circuit in the United States. And then we put all the rest of the states in another one, and I believe we give them 12 or 15, somewhere in that range. That means we create some more judgeships for this conglomeration of states and islands and territories. And my hope is that we can achieve a better court in both cases by doing so.
Senator, our time together has come to an end. We appreciate the fact that you need to run off for a town hall meeting. Let me say, on behalf of the City Club, how much we appreciate your taking time to join us today. And we are going to invite you back because we have 75 more questions. Thank you so much.
I have another 30-minute speech, too.
An audio archive of all past Idaho Falls City Club forums is available at ifcityclub.com. This is KISU Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg, broadcasting from the campus of Idaho State University in Pocatello.